The Guardian.
The joy of ebooks is that great stories are just a click away. For our podcast listeners, we have a great offer on Luke Harding's book Mafia State, a menacing tale of life as a journalist in present-day Russia. I'll tell you more at the end of the show.
Football Weekly Extra.
Just when we're really enjoying our international campaign, club football has to come along and interrupt everything. Today, though, the midweek action from England-Poland, not the kind of ruthless performance Roy was after, to Danke, Sweden's astonishing Berlin Blitz, from Northern Ireland with a point in Portugal, to France not losing with Spain. All of that rounded up, oh yes, and Serbia. Then we turn our head reluctantly towards the weekend's league action, but what's this? Big matches abroad, Juve-Napoli, and in the Premier League too, with Sunderland-Newcastle and Spurs-Chelsea, the league leaders against a man with a good track record at making them lose, Andre Villas-Boas. All of that, plus your top posts in today's Football Weekly Extra. Right, off we go then with another Thursday instalment of the latest from the wild and often crazy world of football. Barry Glendening's here, looking pensive. Barry, good morning.
Hello.
Yep, Tom Lutz is here too. Hi, Tom. And also, it's James Horncastle.
Hello.
Hi, James. We're going to be working together this weekend.
Apparently so, yeah.
Woo! Into Catania. That's not in part one, though. What is?
You weren't saying woo probably about when you found out you were covering Inter Catania, because you were hoping to be covering something
better. Yeah, but now I've begun to think a bit more deeply. Yeah. You know, often you have to look behind the kind of the big games to, you know, the little nuggets hidden elsewhere in the fixtures. Yeah, anyway, England-Poland. Barry, you had the exciting task Tuesday of doing the minute-by-minute.
Yeah, and it took only marginally less time than it would have taken to do the minute-by-minute of an actual game.
Right.
Because it took them so long to postpone it.
Right, yeah.
Which seemed weird because there was absolutely no question that the match was going to take place. And yet we were left with this sort of ludicrous scenario of the referee coming out to bounce the ball around on a pitch.
Yeah, yeah.
He had tried to bounce it around 45 minutes previously in the vain hope that it might be more playable despite having been considerably wetter.
Right.
The match was postponed.
The roof, you presumably are all over this roof business. It couldn't be closed because what? There was too much water on it?
It couldn't be closed because it was raining too heavily.
Right, yeah. Okay.
And
Had they left it open to make the pitch particularly stodgy? You know, against, you know, possession-based England and that.
Well, according to the nice lady who was trying to explain sort of the Polish FA's equivalent of Adrian Bevington, communications director, she said that they had expected heavy rain,
yeah,
but not a deluge.
Right.
I'm not quite sure what that means, but they hadn't closed the roof,
right,
couldn't, and they didn't have anyone out prodding the pitch with forks.
Well, famously, there were no forks.
Oh, there weren't forks.
No, they don't have forks in.
But they were supposedly in favour of leaving it open because,
right,
I think they played with the roof closed. Was it against Greece in
the opening game? Yeah, it was very, very humid. Of course, that was in July or June.
Yeah, back in the summer.
Yeah,
and it was. I think it was like doing Bikram yoga in
yeah,
a
football
stadium.
Again, it was in the summer. I'm thinking that could be a relevant factor here. But anyway, then they put the roof closed the next day, and England had a game.
Yeah, but I thought the postponement was actually more entertaining than the game.
Really? I quite enjoyed the game, actually. There were plenty of chances.
Yeah, I thought it was quite underwhelming.
Tom?
I think there was... we kind of led this morning with the England players having to take sleeping pills to
having
sleep.
First taken caffeine pills?
Yeah, which is, I don't know, on the drugs scale, what that,
right,
does to you, whether, whether the upper cancels out the downer.
Right.
But anyway, and this was kind of given as a mild excuse, but presumably the Polish players were also in exactly the same position and maybe needed sleeping pills as well. So if they were up as well, I mean, I imagine they get just as excited as,
right,
England players about internationals, if,
right,
not more so, particularly if they're
playing.
I did
find
home.
It a bit strange. I don't know if this is something that's commonplace, is it, for England to take Pro Plus or whatever it was they were on before a big fixture?
I don't know.
Hmm? And England lucky to get away with the point?
I think it was a fair result.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like the pitch made a real difference because it's, I think you touched on it earlier, it's not like England pinging it about like Spain anyway. So it probably suited England just as much as Poland. I guess this was one of the first games after John Terry stepped down. I mean, there was San Marino, but that doesn't really count. And that wasn't too much of a problem, really, because you've got Lescott and Jagielka.
They didn't look very comfortable, though, did they?
No, well, I don't think they missed a John Terry throw-yourself-about figure. I saw Jagielka and Lescott both doing that. But what I think they do miss is someone who can bring it out of defence like Ferdinand. And that was kind of causing the midfield to have to drop back a bit to bring the ball out. And that meant Rooney had to drop back, which meant Defoe was more isolated. So I think that kind of did cost them. So it wasn't Terry's absence so much as Ferdinand's that was the problem for me.
Rooney, good with his shoulder, good with his shins.
Both of them. Yep. All-round player, yep.
Yep, excellent stuff. Anything else you wanted to say about this game?
Well, they were terrible. Absolutely, like, awful. Lucky to escape with a point.
Well, that's
they can point at the pitch, but I would suspect the pitch. Poland suffered a lot more because of the pitch than England did because they're.
Were you listening when Tom said this? Very
Baz never listened. Baz last listened to me, I think, in 2007, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm making a different point to the one he made.
Go on.
Poland's entire game is all about quick counterattacks, which playing on a pudding pitch precludes them from doing that. They were a bit too cautious in the first half, I think, and should have taken more advantage of England's constant mistakes and constant habit of gifting them possession. And England were probably lucky to get away with a point and should be thoroughly ashamed of a very bad performance.
There you go.
One thing that will save England in that group is that everybody else is just as bad as them and they're just taking points off each other. So Ukraine lost to Macedonia.
But Montenegro have kind of emerged. I think they beat the Ukraine away from home. They've got a game in hand, which happens to be San Marino, which I think if they win, they'll go top of the group.
And only the top of the group is guaranteed qualification.
Yes. Mm. And obviously, we have a bit of recent history with Montenegro. They've proven quite difficult. They've got, you know, Jovetic and Vucinic and Rooney loves playing them. And so I think it's going to be quite tricky. I mean, the thing that galls me is there's just a seemed lack of progress. I mean, I saw one stat today, which was like it's the fourth time in 11 of Roy's games in England where they've only registered one shot on target, which is just...
Is that all they have? One shot on target?
Apparently so, yeah.
My word. Well, in the meantime, England's under-21s sealed their place in next summer's 2013 under-21 European Championship in a very controversial game there. Where was this game played?
Krušovac.
Was it?
Is that how you pronounce it?
All right, then. Yeah, in which all sorts of bad things happened. The charges of racial abuse, which when you see some of the videos of, seem to be pretty clear-cut. A lot of monkey chants from the fans. Also, these extraordinary scenes at the end, and one doesn't want to take sides without the right evidence, but it does seem that the English party are attacked as they make their way to the tunnel, and possibly I'm misinterpreting that. But anyway, very unpleasant scenes at the end. The big question now, what's going to happen about it? A four-match ban, presumably, if the English FA were in charge, but this is up to UEFA, so...
15 grand fine, maybe?
15 grand. Well, I don't know. The amount of precedents now that are built up on Serbia's account are quite... It's quite lengthy, no?
Yeah, they have a very long rap sheet, and people are saying they should be banned from international competition. Johnson Wilson wrote an interesting article yesterday saying that should only be done as a last resort.
Is this not perhaps the last resort, though?
Well, I can see where Jonathan's coming from. I don't necessarily agree with him because how many more chances are they going to get? I think the big problem here is that their FA and now their government refuse to acknowledge the problem. They're taking the approach to just deny it happened. And they can't. I mean, the only way, unless the crowd was actually thousands of monkeys, I don't see how they can defend it. So I think it's time to ban them. But then I can also see Johnson's point. The phrase he used would be an example of fuck you isolation, you know. And
yeah, I was quite staggered by that.
Yeah, it's a good turn of phrase, though, but... I don't like seeing Wilson go all potty mouth like that.
No.
But, you know, I think banning them, it's like if a kid gets expelled from school, a constant trouble. Do you just abandon them and throw them in the scrap heap, or do you try and nurture them? Possibly send someone in to help them.
Send someone in to help them,
Barry. The A-team.
Right.
Look, it's not so long ago
they
that...
They would be in, though, would they?
That it's not so long ago that another team's fans in Europe were travelling around singing racist songs and misbehaving on a grand scale. I didn't hear any British journalists calling on them for to be banned from European competition or anything. And they have since improved, so it can be done.
Well, we'll talk more about Spain later on. But I know I get where you're going with that. Very interesting. Not sure about the A-team business, though.
Well, no, not necessarily the A-team, but possibly we'll send someone in to help them.
Gordon Ramsay.
Get to the bottom of the problem.
Right, okay, now. All right, well, that was a bad side of international football this week. This was the good side.
Kjellström, 92:15 på klockan. Kjellström, ett långt inspel i straffområdet mot Ibrahimovic panna. Och så går bollen för Elm, så skjuter
Ivan!
Rasmus Elm gör fullständigt osannolika 4-4 för Sverige i Berlin mot Tyskland.
So that was Lasse Granqvist, of course, and friend, going quite absolutely bonkers over one of the most bonkers results we've seen in a very long time in club international football, whatever. A lot of people calling this the greatest international comeback ever. I'm referring, of course, to the extraordinary 60 minutes of heaven, 30 minutes of hell, as the Germans called it, Germany-Sweden 4-4.
Just on that commentary.
Yeah.
People go on about Brazilian commentators, how brilliant they are in the Samba lifestyle, and then people criticise Scandinavians for being dour. But the two bits of Scandinavian commentary I've ever heard, the famous Maggie Thatcher, la-di-da, and that, how excited are they?
Very, very exciting.
It's underrated Scandinavian commentary.
But there you go.
Yeah.
Good, Tom.
I'd like to have heard the chef from the Muppet Show.
Quite possibly you did. Well, of course, you underestimate the Swedes at your peril, a lesson that Germany learned all too late this week. Here is Raphael Honigstein. Raphael, how are you?
Very well, James.
Excellent.
How are you?
I'm ever so well, Raphael, ever so well. You were riffing on Ireland's pain just the other day when we last spoke. Seems to me that paybacks are... Well, karma's come back to bite you in the bottom.
Possibly, yes. I mean, it seems to be that the players were getting carried away with their own brilliance a little way on Tuesday night. They were playing so well. Some papers said that it was probably the best combination football they'd ever seen from a German team, at least sort of in living memory. They were that good and that thrilling. Unfortunately, they forgot that there is actually another side of the game and your own half to take care of. And a loss of concentration led to panic and took advantage.
The Swedes took advantage.
Miracle.
Right. It's kind of a descent into onanistic self-regard. Is that right?
I'm not sure I would use that word, but I can understand where you're coming from, James.
Right, understood. Okay, so at half-time, the crowd in Berlin were over the moon, and you were watching, could you believe what you were seeing?
No, it was tough. I mean, it wasn't just half-time. It was until the 60th minute they were leading 4-0 and playing really, really well. Even after the 4-1, they were still creating chances and playing some beautiful football. The panic really well and truly set in when they scored the third one with 15 minutes to go. And then it was just a terrible loss of shape and everything went wrong. And also the substitutions from Lewis were very questionable because he brought in two more attackers. Yeah, he basically changed the next leg with two attacking players, Götze and Podolski, coming on. Of course, that didn't really help the team who were struggling to get a foothold back in this game. And it, of course, leads to bigger questions. A, why can't this Germany team not defend anymore? Why does Löw not take control when he sees things are going wrong? And the most damning of all, which is not personally what I subscribe to, but which has always been in the background with this team, is do they lack the character? Is there something wrong with this sort of genetic makeup? Do they not have the winning mentality that you need? So unfortunately, Germany, despite all their brilliance in the last few years, those very damaging questions and that kind of line of inquiry will continue until they actually win anything, which, you know, it will take at least 1.5 years. So it's a debate that's going to be with us for a few more months.
Right. In the meantime, of course, this result lets the door wide open for Republic of Ireland to storm back into the qualifying. No, Barry, you're shaking your head?
Well, no, it's a bad result for the Republic of Ireland. It would be better for us if Germany had beaten Sweden, because we assume Germany are going to top the group anyway, which I would imagine they very much will.
Has there ever been a result like this in Germany's football history, Rafa?
No, they've never thrown away a 4-goal lead, ever.
You're never more vulnerable than when you're 4-0 up as
yeah, precisely.
Right, and what's the reaction been like at home?
Disbelief, shock, turning to a bit of anger as well. As I said to you, some of the questions that have haunted the Löw and the side are coming back. Lack of leadership being mentioned as sort of a favourite topic for Germany. We thought after the Ireland game that the period of sort of introspective doubts and all that kind of stuff was over. And now it's come back, and Ireland now looks like the blip where everyone thought, now, you know, we're back to normal. And all the debates and all the problems that were mentioned after the defeat by Italy have now come back. And because the next game is against Holland in November, there's a good chance that this year might end quite badly for Joachim Löw. And, you know, with him probably not renewing his contract in 2014, there is almost a sense of, you know, this is the final chapter in his career, and people are no longer so sure that it's going to be a happy end.
Everywhere in media's Raphael Honigstein. There you go.
He's done very well out of that game.
Barry, you're so cynical.
I'm not cynical. You can't turn on a telly or radio without Honigstein being there discussing his national team's brilliance, followed by their shortcomings. They did make a lot of very bad errors, but I think it's just a freak result.
Really?
They got 4-0 up, they got lazy, switched off, and then once Sweden obviously had the momentum, and it was hard for them to get going again.
There you go. It was Germany-Sweden.
Half-time team talk. Did you hear about that?
No, I didn't.
He apparently did all of the coaching in the halftime team talk to the point where
who did say I missed the first bit.
Zlatan.
Oh, Zlatan's halftime team talk, right?
Eric Cameron, the coach, said, "Yeah, he was, after the game, very very impressed with Ibrahimovic because he took everyone to one side, if you can do that in the dressing room, and imparted his wisdom. I don't know whether that means he shouted at them and throttled them, but he was very classy in the way he acted, apparently, and a true captain.
Right."
Not what you expected.
I can see that happening, actually. Yeah. Think what you will of Ibrahimovic. You can imagine him holding their attention and more besides, very probably. Lots of people commenting on this game. Marco Sullivan, don't mention the draw. Now, that's enough for part one. And we've still got loads more. Well, a bit more international with things like Scotland, Wales. Hey, Northern Ireland. That's going to be up after this. More international football. Scotland had to win in Belgium. They didn't, of course. Saw a little bit of this game. It was a little bit like when an advanced race from the future visits cavemen, and the cavemen are kind of wandering around befuddled by the futuristic Zappa stuff. The Scots were wandering around the pitch, entirely bewildered by this team that was just passing the ball around them. It was a bit like 2001, you know, the apes with the monoliths at the start. There was lots of... Yeah, anyway, so it didn't go well, and they're all saying Craig Levein's out now.
It is easy... Well... It is easy to blame Levein because it's partly his fault.
Right.
But
the players were...
Scotland were motivated for that game and they were trying their hearts out. That's what was disturbing, and they still got destroyed.
Yeah.
And it's actually just they lack the technical skills to keep possession and pass the ball.
They have quite a good core of players for the first time in a while. And following on from what you said, quite a lot, they were up for that game. And a lot of the players have come out and kind of been very, very defensive of Levein, particularly like Darren Fletcher. Someone said to me the other day that maybe Levein is the coaching equivalent of a player who does it all in training. You know, he's the player who shows himself in training. He doesn't replicate it on the big...
He's no Zlatan, that's what we're saying.
He's no Zlatan.
All right. Well, in the meantime, Wales, who had, of course, have beaten Scotland... then lost in Croatia, so they're not doing very well. Republic of Ireland bounced back well. Hey, Barry. And Trapattoni, his job secure now?
Yeah, he's played the FAI like a fiddle. And they wouldn't support him before the Faroe Islands game, which would suggest that either they didn't trust him enough to win that game against the Faroes to back him, or else the guy who pays his salary has told them what to do.
Right, trap staying on then. Northern Ireland, in the meantime, how extraordinary was this game? You watched it, no? They went to Portugal. They almost got a win.
Yeah, they were 1-0 up and defending obdurately and heroically. Bodies on the line stuff, good saves from the keeper. A bit of luck as well. Portugal were sort of peppering their goal and lots of near misses. And it looked like very much like it was going to be one of those nights for Portugal and another famous Northern Irish victory. But sadly, Portugal scored with about 10 minutes to go. But and in pouring rain, then continued to try and get a winner but couldn't. And draw. Yeah, fair result. Brilliant result for Northern Ireland.
Ronaldo's 100th game. He was given a special award, I think, before the match, no? How did he do?
Not very well.
Not very well?
You can't do it on the big occasions. No, I'm only joking. Yeah, he didn't perform. It was Helder Postiga.
Yep.
Who always seems to come up trumps for Portugal, which is kind of odd, given his... well, I'm basing him on his Spurs days.
Right, perhaps unreliable. But it was Portugal who were Helder, in this case, as Northern Ireland come away with a terrific point. Well done to them. Now,
Ireland seem to have a habit of, you know, they'll occasionally pull rabbits out of the hat. They get fantastic results that, and then go and get beaten 4-0 at home by Iceland or something. This consistency seems to be a problem for them. And they're, you know, obviously they're pretty limited because they have a small pool of not particularly good players to pick from. But I just don't know why they can't be more consistent.
Why? I don't know. Come on, Northern Ireland, be more consistent, for goodness sake.
There used to be a song. It was either tourism or employment, trying to boost that in the province of Ulster. And it was just, come on, Northern Ireland, come on.
Right.
There's a whole lot of work to be done.
Okay.
So I think they should apply that to their football team.
Right, it's a song they could be singing in Spain as well. The Iberians suffering an unexpected draw as well. First time in 5 years in qualifying, they didn't win their match. It was a very, very late, I think 95th minute equaliser from Olivier Giroud. And, I think we've got the Sid on the phone to tell us all about it.
Hello, James. How you doing?
I'm very well, Sid. Nice to speak to you.
And to you.
Extraordinary. Epochal after 7 consecutive games. Casillas finally conceding a goal. After 24 consecutive victories in qualifiers, Spain not winning.
Yeah, it's amazing, really. The reaction's been huge. Because, and then you think about it, you think, well, a 1-1 draw at home against France is hardly a disgrace. But it is a big deal. And it more difficult for Spain. I still think they'll get through. To be honest, I still think they'll win the group. But what was most interesting about it was the way that not only did Spain not win, but the way they lost control, which just hasn't really happened over the last 3 or 4 years.
Lost control where? Midfield?
They lost control in the area of the pitch that they normally completely dominate. There's a huge space in the middle of midfield. Every time that France came forward, Spain still had more of the ball, but every time that France came forward, it opened up in front of them. Spain played with Sergio Busquets at centre-back, which isn't necessarily a problem in terms of Busquets being a bad centre-back, because it turns out he's actually quite a good centre-back. But it is a problem in terms of losing him from the middle of the pitch. And I think that ended up causing them real problems.
So basically they've got loads of attacking kind of creative midfielders, but not too many of the Busquets breaking up play style.
Well, the key really is that Spain with Vicente del Bosque have always played with Xabi Alonso and Busquets in the middle of midfield, really, really deep and protecting them and controlling the ball. And actually, del Bosque has been criticised an awful lot for that, because there's been a suggestion that he needs only one person there. Luis Aragonés only had Marcos Senna there, and the rest were more creative. And Spain lost a touch of creativity to gain a little bit more control. Because of the injuries at centre-back, Del Bosque went for Sergio Busquets at centre-back and therefore had only one defensive midfielder, Xabi Alonso, on his own. And they suffered for it. And, you know, under normal circumstances, you play, say, a slightly weaker team and perhaps it wouldn't matter. But against a team as good as France, even though France are still finding their feet and still not a great side, then you're going to, well, you're going to, they did pay for it.
All right. Not a sellout this game, I hear, Sid.
Yeah, that was the most surprising thing about it. And I must confess, I feel a little bit conned by the Spanish Federation for this, because they made a point of saying, I think it was 2 days before the game, right, the final tickets are going on sale tomorrow, the final few tickets. And I think they said that there was 3,000 tickets going on sale. It turned out that the morning of the game, there were 13,000 tickets going on sale in the Calderon, which holds, I think I'm right in saying, 53,000, something like that. So 13,000 tickets go on sale. They didn't all sell out. Ticket prices were between 30 and 85 euros. So I suppose at the bottom end, 30 is not that extreme, although it's relatively expensive. At the top end, it is expensive, particularly with the crisis in Spain. And it didn't fill, which for a game that big is I think, a real message, a real warning for the problems that Spanish football and, of course, Spanish society is facing.
Yeah, especially because it's not like you can go home and watch them on TV anymore, Spain, is it?
Well, you could on Tuesday night.
Right, they did actually televise this one.
You're right in saying that the one at the weekend wasn't. The one on the Friday night wasn't away in Belarus.
Crikey. Sid, thank you ever so much for that. Is there a big game this weekend in the Liga?
Well, I must admit, I'm not sure this weekend's games are particularly exciting, but I suppose it's interesting for Real Madrid, James, because they've got none of their fullbacks available.
Oh, crikey. Well, look forward
to that. The virus FIFA, they call it.
The virus FIFA.
Or the FIFA virus, I suppose, if you translate it properly.
FIFA fever. You might.
FIFA fever.
If you wanted. Okay, Sid, that's brilliant. Thanks ever so much for that. And look forward to catching up with you soon.
My pleasure. See you on Monday.
Cheers, Sid. Booking himself in rather presumptuously for appearance on Monday's Football Weekly. See what we can do. Maybe we'll have our answering machine on. I don't know, Barry. Right, that's probably enough international football, though there was loads of other things. There was, for example, Italy. Mm-hmm. With just 10 men. The San Siro, a deserted San Siro, James, but those who did turn up saw a fantastic goal by Mario Balotelli, didn't they?
It was all about Balotelli. He laid on the assist for the first goal. He got kicked and kicked and kicked by Daniel Agger, didn't respond. In fact, as you were saying, they went down to 10 men. It was Osvaldo, not Balotelli, who got sent off. And just as everything looked in jeopardy for Italy, there were 2-1 up, down to 10 men. Who was it? See them through. It's Balotelli.
Oh no! It's fantastic ball from Pirlo, and he just. How would you describe it? He just taps it around the. He kind of volleys it, kind of one touch to kind of latches onto it midair and takes it around the keeper.
It was a magical goal.
I can confirm that after the game for people who are interested, Mario Balotelli got a Ryanair flight home, had got a police escort to the gate, which is super priority boarding. And had 3 seats to himself on the plane. And he was wearing a black jacket with a silver skull and crossbones on the back.
All right. How do you know all this, Barry?
Opta.
Okay.
They have
good
stats on it.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, there'll be a big roundup of a lot of the European reaction to some extraordinary midweek results in Friday morning's Euro paper review, naturally enough, here at guardian.co.uk. Barry.
I genuinely didn't know.
Stop. Anyway, now, this weekend, hey, I mentioned Inter Catania before, and I'm looking forward to my trip to the San Siro. It's not the only big game this weekend in Italy, is it?
No, this Juve-Napoli top of the table clash.
Top of the table?
Which is...
North v South?
Exactly, and after the kind of austerity and dull affair that was the Milan derby, this is being billed as the big rivalry that's developing.
Cool.
And there's Milan-Lazio, which, isn't...
Could be Allegri's last game.
Indeed. Will it or will not? I don't know.
I don't know either.
But
boy, I'm going to tune into some Serie A this weekend. That's for dang sure. Now, not the only top league that's furnishing some pretty hot-looking fixtures. You've also got the Premier League. Whoa, what a way to come back. Spurs, Chelsea, Sunderland, Newcastle. Before we get onto those, though, I think it's time for some posts and texts. John Ashdown's Adjectival 11. This produced quite a lot of comment. Some of it from people who are not aware of what an adjective is. Alan Brazil, not a part of this. I don't think Brazil qualifies as an adjective in that usage. But other people did post in with suggestions for John's putative team full of people with names that sound a bit like awesome and that. Well, that's how it started anyway. Fabian Cool says Little Room. Oh, and also Happy Goth. Philippa B mentions Tim Krul. CU says Harry Bland, like the one Shepus, Dean Brill. Van der Vaart next says, I'd probably want to have Leo Messi in my adjective 11. Aware of Acuity, Wonderboy Mitch Charlie, although I'm not sure he says if he is a real player. And then Jason Colley says, for awesome named footballers, you can't beat a Batman Farigi of Papua New Guinea. Indeed, New Zealand couldn't, losing 1-0 to them. Very, very interesting. In other top post news, we launched an appeal for celebrity listeners, Barry.
And we got...
It bore fruit.
The bass player from EMF?
We certainly did. Stevie Marsh, I'm the bass player of EMF! Exclamation mark. I think everything they said EMF had to have an exclamation mark at the end, didn't it?
That's unbelievable.
Well, yeah, that's what Man United Bruin said some days ago.
I saw Paolo. He was on
Paolo
Twitter.
Bandini.
Paolo Bandini.
Right.
He was conversing on Twitter with the Happy Mondays.
Really? Which
they
one?
They were asking him about Serie A, I think.
Which Happy Monday?
I don't know. I think it was just their specific Twitter account.
Well, that's obviously run by some record company lackey.
Maybe.
Yeah. Paolo Bandini, eh? Cool. Mm. He's moved on, hasn't he? Anyway, yeah, nice to hear from you, Stevie Marsh. Ches Dozy, also.
Daryl Breen also listens.
Yeah.
On his way home from gigs.
There you go.
Billy Bean.
Of course.
Moneyball fame.
Of Moneyball fame, yeah. Of course. And Ches Dozy, who was on Rolf Harris's Christmas special in 1980. And also on there, special time for TV and presenters in the 80s, of course. Topical subject. This darts were on, remember darts? And Keith Harrison Orville, who's one of probably the second most famous presenter for having his hand up somebody's costume in the 80s, Keith Harris. He said, moving along. Anyway, right. If you are a celebrity, don't forget to let us know right now, though. We'll move on to part three. How about that? Spurs-Chelsea. Chelsea don't win at Spurs, do they? Just like Spurs don't win at Old Trafford. Am I right, Tom?
I suppose if
they just won at Old Trafford last time out, yeah.
Well, I think obviously the thing that sticks out about this game is AVB returning to Chelsea. I think it's more than anything, I think his pride was hurt with what happened at Chelsea, and I think he thought he was almost following Abramovich's instructions in disciplining the players heavily, and then that's what kind of helped lose him his job. So I think there is a bit of, not bitterness, but he wants to prove what he can do, and I think it's perhaps one of the reasons why he stayed in English football rather than taking a job at Valencia or Sao Paulo, which he was offered before the Spurs game, and this is his chance to come back. And
right.
And he's shown that he can work with players, which was a criticism under Chelsea, that there are Spurs players that have come on really well this season. Sandro, Kyle Walker.
Colker, yeah. Working in the newspaper business, you'll be aware of the anti-Villa Spurs agenda. And I'm not actually joking too much about this, because it was clearly they were out to get him from the start of the season. Now, though, this unbeaten run of consecutive victories, but unbeaten, in fact, in 10 games since the opening day in all competitions. Do you think that the media's now swung round behind him, or are they waiting for the first slip to stick the knife back in?
I'm sure when he slips, we'll stick the knife back in.
Good. Chelsea, of course, coming into this top of the table.
Yeah, I kind of think this will be their sternest test,
really?
Post-Arsenal.
Mm.
Because I think Tottenham have been extremely good in recent weeks. I think they reached a real turning point in that QPR game when they were trailing at half-time and were outplayed. And Villas-Boas made a few changes. He shifted Vertonghen to left-back. And that's sort of been the system ever since. He seems to have found the best way to get Spurs playing. And I think if you going back to that point, well, will we keep putting the knife into Villas-Boas? I think after the United victory away, now if he lays these demons to rest with Chelsea, I think he'll probably, it's a big step towards acceptance.
Mm. All right. It went well for Chelsea last time they met Spurs, a 5-1 win, but that game was at Wembley. Of course, it was the FA Cup semi-final. Barry, were you saying this morning you thought Spurs were going to win this match?
No.
Oh. What do you think is going to happen?
I think Spurs are not going to win this, but I think... I haven't really had an opinion
on it.
Have you
not?
No.
Okay.
I mean, Hazard was... He didn't play for Belgium against Scotland.
Yeah.
The other day because apparently he didn't... He wasn't committed enough against Serbia. He switched off a little bit.
Oh, really?
He wasn't tracking back and such. So Mark Wilmot sort of disciplined him and said, well, you'll sit this one out.
Mm.
So he'll be nice and fresh for the game.
Right. Of course, Jermaine Defoe won't be because he had to stay an extra day in Poland.
Yes. Mm. And those sleeping pills.
And the sleeping pills, yeah.
Right. Isn't it a well-documented fact that may not be a fact at all and be totally factually incorrect that Chelsea invariably lose after an international break?
I don't know.
I should have checked.
If they win or lose, Barry, and in that, you share something with Fernando Torres.
Yeah, apparently so.
Interesting interview. Refreshingly frank.
It's hardly the revelation of the century that a player who is not being picked for his team, whether that team is Spain or Chelsea or anyone else.
Or this pod
is going to get to a point where they genuinely don't care whether the team wins or loses. I would imagine oftentimes the player will want his team to lose so that he gets back in the side.
It was interesting what he said. He said, there are lots of players like this and I've always despised them. And then one day I realised that I was doing the same thing. So it was, I think it was an attempt to be kind of slightly cathartic about it. This is a classic thing of a footballer going back to his national team and then, you know, he meets a bloke from El Pais who probably knew very well and gave this quite revelatory.
But was he specifically talking about Chelsea? I know that's what the media over here have picked up on, but it could also have been referring to the Spanish team when he wasn't getting into their side
either.
That's
true. Or any other team he was thinking about. Interesting. Do you care if Sunderland beat Newcastle this weekend, Barry?
I would love if they beat Newcastle. Sunderland's biggest win in the league ever was in 1908 over Newcastle. They beat them 9-1. Now, there are no players left from that side in the Sunderland team, but I'm very confident they can carry forward that form and momentum and turn over Newcastle.
They don't have a good record of late against Newcastle.
No, they've only won 1 in 15 against the Magpies, and their last encounter was a draw in which Sunderland tried to kick them off the field. This may not happen on Sunday because Lee Cattermole is suspended, which is probably a good thing for Sunderland because he'd only get sent off again.
Right.
Well, are Krull, Colaccini and Taylor back for this game?
That's a good question.
Because they got that was the big problem against United there.
Certainly was.
I don't know. I mean, it's two teams who were playing badly and haven't really impressed much. Sunderland, the last time I saw them play was against Manchester City and they were pitiful. It was an absolutely abject display. They were clearly beaten before they even set foot on the pitch and made no apparent effort at all. I'm sure that won't happen on Sunday, but I wouldn't be confident. If I had to bet on something, I'd probably go for a draw.
Really? Okay. Meantime, Tom Lutz, Birmingham's team, West Bromwich Albion, are going to be hosting the champions Man City. I see this as a potential banana skin for City. Shall I explain why?
Yes.
Well, first of all, you got your West Brom up in six, and they've already caused huge problems for other teams. They beat Liverpool 3-0 there at the Hawthorns. B, Aguero and Tevez are just coming back from an extraordinarily arduous international break trip to Bolivia, playing up in La Paz at, 10,000 metres or something like that, where you vomit for breakfast pretty much because there's just oxygen debt. It's catastrophic. And then you've got to fly back afterwards. I mean, it's hellish. And, Silva's out injured as well. Silva's out.
But Balotelli's in form.
Oh, but Balotelli's in form, yeah.
So Zoltan Gira, though.
So Zoltan Gira, what did he do something?
Scored for Hungary.
Wow.
But Balotelli's probably still on his Ryanair flight waiting for the steps to be put up against the door so he can get off it.
Wow, I hope they're not litigious. The other Man City news, Yaya Toure is going to miss a month, well, potentially a month, with the Africa Cup of Nations because that's all been sorted now and the Toures will be going. But anyway, what do you think? Man City to drop points at the Hawthorns? Yeah, come on, James. Chom, help me out here.
It didn't particularly spring at me. I think Baz was saying about Liverpool-Reading, and I kind of agree that...
Liverpool-Reading? You'd rather talk about Liverpool-Reading. Go on, then.
I just think that's more of a chance of...
a home win for Liverpool?
of Reading, if not winning.
Really?
Their form, which admittedly was terrible at the start of the season, has improved of late. They've drawn the last two and they threw away the lead in the last two and they could have won. And I think they've scored in every game but one this season.
Is this Reading?
Yeah.
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 Okay.
And Rayner's probably going to be out for Liverpool.
Right.
Johnson and Gerrard will have been playing for England as well.
Sleeping pills.
Yeah, we've touched on the sleeping pills. I could see Reading... Yeah. Getting a point there, definitely.
The other interesting thing is Borini is out for 3 months with a fracture.
Right.
But yeah, they've only got Suarez is only the only senior striker they have available to them, which has always been the sort of shadow hanging over Liverpool after that transfer window when they missed out on Dempsey and let Carroll go to West Ham. So.
Right. Wow, doesn't sound good. And this is Barry, this is what the game you were actually saying you saw an update. You thought Reading might actually win.
I think they're a great price. They're nearly 10-1, and I'm going to have a bet on them. With any huge amount of confidence, I think it's a weird price.
In other news, Man United are hosting Stoke. Potters haven't won away from the Britannia Stadium in a very, very long time. Tom Lutz, have a go at this one.
No.
What secret are you guarding there so jealously?
I haven't really got anything
have you
to
not?
Say about
Buddy Norwich. All right, Norwich Arsenal, Tom. West Ham, Southampton. No Vaste, he's out for 3 months.
Yep.
That's not good, is it?
It's not.
All right, then.
It's quite an interesting fixture list this weekend. It seems like there could be quite a few upsets, which means there'll probably be none whatsoever.
Well, where else do you see these upsets? Norwich Arsenal? Giroud to bag a brace, I reckon.
What, you think?
No, well, that would be an upset.
No, I don't know. I think
Mertesacker was pulled for Germany. Koscielny gave away that penalty, which Lloris then saved.
There was that.
So both centre-backs not particularly in good form. Maybe.
All right,
I don't know.
Okay, Fulham Aston Villa. Swansea Wigan.
Benteke did quite well.
All right, I've got one left, one shot left, one bullet. I'm going to make it count. QPR Everton. Could this be Mark Hughes' valedictory performance? Take your time. You've got six minutes until...
Sorry, you're asking if it could be his last performance before he gets fired?
Yeah.
He can always go back to being Elsa in Home and Away.
That's true. Mm. I meant at Rangers, of course.
Well, they seem... They keep giving him votes of confidence and tweets of confidence and whatnot. He said after they stayed up last season that QPR will never be in this position with me again.
Right.
But if he doesn't get fired, it seems that there's every chance they will be.
Right.
So, except they won't stay up this time.
Mm.
And for a team to have spent so much money to be so apparently hapless seems quite strange. I don't like calling for people to lose their jobs, but he does seem to have a very patient chairman in Tony Fernandez, and you'd wonder how long that patience will last.
Right, Tom, it's Tom Lutz.
I've got a point to make. I guess the fact that Everton are doing so well this season means that a loss against them would not be a disgraceful result, which would kind of help him as well. If it's against another club struggling, that might make a difference. But I've got I've got a feeling that... as Baz was saying, Fernandez seems to be behind him. I think he'll give him at least till January.
Right, you're quite... Shame on me for trying to hype this up with someone's job with someone's job in question and that. Well, there you go. That's it for today. Many, many thanks to you all for being here, for a terrific rip-roaring...
For being Football Week.
Very much so, yeah.
Have you got your three envelopes? But the people who are going to let you down this season.
You've got a portrait of yourself in your flat.
I've got that, yeah. But the envelopes, that could be the trick for next time. Super stuff. Many thanks to producer Ben, Barry Glendening, Tom Lutz and James Horncastle. And then we'll see you on Monday. Have a super weekend.
Hey, guys, remember me? Don't forget to check out Jimbo's paper review. There's a new one up on Friday at guardian.co.uk/football.
For a limited period only, we have an exclusive ebook offer for Guardian podcast listeners. Guardian columnist Luke Harding's Mafia State is a dark and ominous insight into the life of a journalist in present-day Russia. We're offering 30% off the list price of $4.99. All you have to do is go to the ebook store www.kobo.com, that's KOBO.com, and at checkout, put in the discount code MAFIASTATE for your Guardian podcast offer.